start by reading from on March 19th, the day before the anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. Donald Rumsfeld, our great Secretary of State, made a statement in the New York Times. He printed an op-ed piece, and so I just want to read from that because it's all about how great the invasion was and the occupation is justified and all of that. I'll just pick up toward the end of the speech. As the continuing terrorist violence in Iraq reminds us, the road to self-governance will be challenging, but the progress is impressive. Last week, the Iraqi Governing Council unanimously signed an interim constitution. It guarantees freedom of religion and expression, the right to assemble and to organize political parties, the right to vote, and the right to a fair, speedy, and open trial. It prohibits discrimination based on gender, nationality, and religion, as well as arbitrary arrest and detention. A year ago today, none of these protections could have been even imagined by the Iraqi people, end quote. So this is Donald Rumsfeld. And in fact, Iraqis who I met actually did imagine those kinds of things possibly coming from the U.S. invasion. What they found was that what Rumsfeld is saying, the Iraq that he's describing, is absolutely false, as the Rumsfeld conception of the world usually is pretty false. But I just want to break it down bit by bit. The whole idea that this constitution guarantees freedom of expression. People may have heard that this past week, actually, U.S. troops shut down a popular Shia newspaper that's based in Baghdad. This newspaper was critical of the occupation. So troops showed up in the morning, you know, in their uniforms with their guns, and they actually padlocked the building where this paper is produced. And they claim that they did this because the paper was printing misinformation about the occupation, which I think is very interesting. You know, I'm waiting for the troops to go ahead and padlock the New York Post and the New York Times, Fox News, and, you know, all the other media outlets that are printing misinformation on the occupation. So we see that actually, contrary to the idea that there's freedom of expression in Iraq, the U.S. is cracking down on Iraqi media that are critical of the occupation, instead producing their own U.S. media. First of all, there's the channel Al Iraqiya, which I had the, I guess, privilege of watching when I was in Iraq. They had some weird music videos and, like, this bizarre cooking show. It was like the essence of Emerald except Iraq. You know, and like, the kitchen was not like any kitchen in Iraq. It was just very, you know, very strange. So it's not actually reflecting the reality of Iraqi people. In addition to that, one of the things that I think is interesting, they recently had this, they produced this show called Talents, and it's actually modeled after American Idol, but it's like Iraqi Idol. And the interesting part of it is that it was produced by, I believe, the 82nd Airborne, their psychological operations unit. And so it's like they're actually producing the shows, and the whole idea is, you know, obviously to control people in Iraq. There are also newspapers that the United States is putting out, like this awesome one, Baghdad at a Glance. This is a U.S. English and Arabic language newspaper. The first story, you know, start of cell phone service regarded as a major development in Iraq. Something like 60 people in the country have cell phones out of a population of 26 million. And I'll actually go ahead and use this for the next point. The whole idea that that Iraqis have a right to assemble. And in this newspaper, they actually print what they call the limits of legal demonstrations. Those who wish to publicly gather must submit in writing to the coalition brigade commander. So before you have a demonstration, you have to submit in writing kind of an application. Notice of intent to hold a demonstration at least 24 hours prior to the start of the demonstration. Estimated number, maximum number of persons participating. Names and addresses of organizers. The route of the demonstration, the start time, and the estimated duration of the demonstration. Demonstrators are not allowed to wear, bring, or possess firearms of any description. Of course, U.S. troops, you know, show up with firearms, obviously. Sharpen objects of any kind, projectiles, poles, bats, sticks, or any object that may be used as a club, helmets, masks, or any non-traditional face covering. Demonstrations must not be held on the roads during this time. They give a time. And then demonstrations must not be allowed within 500 meters of any coalition provisional authority facility. So 500 meters is about 5 football fields away, so you can't actually get anywhere near to any of the institutions that you'd actually be protesting. So that's the right to assemble on paper, but as people may know, when peaceful demonstrations do take place in Iraq, actually U.S. troops tend to open fire in them. So the right to assemble really doesn't exist as a right. prohibiting discrimination based on nationality. One of the first things actually that the U.S. did after the invasion was shut down the Palestinian mission in Baghdad, and that's resulted in the expulsion of at least hundreds. I heard that up to 1,000 Palestinians have been expelled from the country. These are Palestinian refugees who came to Iraq, and now they're being expelled out, you know, to be refugees again. And so that kind of thing is happening to Palestinians in Iraq, and there hasn't been much news coverage on that at all. The bit about how Iraqis are no longer subject to arbitrary arrest and detention I found particularly offensive, because actually the United States is detaining thousands arbitrarily. And really all it takes to warrant a detention is an accusation that you're part of the resistance. And I can tell stories, I guess. The worst one was a man named Ahmed Khalif Salman was killed by by U.S. troops. And we actually met with his family the first night that I went to Baghdad. And they told us the story. We went into their house and his brother told us the story about how Ahmed was accused of being part of the resistance. And again, that's all it took to warrant a home invasion. And so troops showed up at 3 in the morning. They blocked off his street with tanks. And then they kicked down his front door. And when Ahmed opened the main door of the house, they shot him in the chest immediately. And so he was actually still alive. And they brought him out into the front yard and let him bleed there. And then went in and terrorized his family, ransacked his house, broke furniture, stole jewelry, stole money. And when they were done, they wrapped his wound, grabbed him by his feet, and dragged him to one of their vehicles, threw him in, and then took off. And his family didn't know where they took him. And so they went looking at different hospitals and detention centers, and they eventually found that he had died, and the troops just dropped off his body. So this is the kind of, you know, these are what I remember during the State of the Union address, President Bush said, you know, we're proud of our troops and their you know, lonely watches and midnight raids. These are the midnight raids that they're actually talking about. This is an example of a detention. Thank you. The U.S. goes to detain someone, they end up actually killing him. I heard a lot of other stories where troops went to detain someone, and they take these people away for being, you know, being supposedly part of the resistance, and their families don't know where they take them to. I'll pass around a photo of a woman I met, and this is in a human rights organization, and this woman is telling a lawyer about how her son was detained. And I was in Iraq in January, and her son was detained in November, and she had no idea where her son was ever since, and he was the main kind of income for their family. She and her husband are too old to work, and so now their main income is gone, and she makes her living by begging on the street. So there are all kinds of arbitrary detentions taking place. The people who run this human rights organization estimate that actually about 18,000 Iraqis are detained in jails throughout the country. At least 10,000 are in a prison called Abu Ghraib, which is it was the most notorious prison under Saddam Hussein's regime, and now it's the main detention facility of the United States, which I think says a lot. There's also arbitrary killing in Iraq all the time. We met people who lost loved ones just because they were caught in the crossfire. We heard from several journalists that when U.S. troops are driving down the street and they're attacked, you know, if they're shot at, their response is just to spray the sidewalk with, you know, with machine gun fire. And so lots and lots of Iraqis are being killed in that way. And then, of course, there are many Iraqis who were killed during the invasion, which is something that we don't hear about at all. We heard that, you know, there was a very clean invasion that used surgical precision. But in fact, the United States used cluster bombs in the attack of Baghdad. And these are big bombs that scatter little, you know, clusters of little bombs across a wide area and kill as many people as possible. That's the whole idea. There's a lot that I could say. I want to move on, and we can go on in the discussion, because I think I can talk more on a lot of these things. When we talk about the state of Iraq today, you have to talk about the economy. The unemployment rate right now, the details are quite sketchy. The United States says that unemployment has fallen down to 30%. But a man named Fala Alwan, who's the head of the Iraqi Trade Union Federation, I had the opportunity to meet him. He said that unemployment is still between 60 and 70% in Iraq. So obviously this is devastating to the economy. They're also working to privatize the economy. And the person put in charge of private sector development is a man named Tom Foley. He's an American, obviously. Tom Foley's not an Iraqi name. And he was actually a Bush campaign fundraiser, and now he's in charge of privatizing Iraq. And what privatization means is that whole parts of the public sector, I mean, Iraq used to be a it was a police state. The state was everything, and so there was a massive public sector. And so whole sections had just been dissolved by the U.S. So, for example, I met a woman from the Ministry of Information who was a news reporter. The whole Ministry of Information was just dissolved because, you know, that's propaganda, even though, you know, like, this isn't propaganda. I mean, that was 6,000 jobs right there, you know, and these people were fired. They weren't given any kind of compensation or anything like that. So they're part of the unemployed now. So, again, there's a lot that we can talk about in terms of the privatization of Iraq, the corporate invasion of Iraq, and we could talk about that kind of thing in the discussion more. One thing, maybe not so obviously, is that the infrastructure in Iraq is falling apart completely, and it's important to understand that what's going on in Iraq now comes after 13 years of an embargo that was imposed on Iraq by the United States and United Nations, through the United Nations, that kept out basic civilian goods, you know, medicines, diapers, pencils, ambulances, all kinds of things like that, and basic construction materials. And so sewage systems are collapsing. There's sewage flowing in the streets of Baghdad. Electrical systems, telephone systems are all falling apart. And electricity still, and telephone service still don't exist in a steady way, you know, even a year after the invasion. Just briefly on the state of women in Iraq, because I think that's important. It's another thing that we're not hearing about. 60% of the unemployed people in Iraq are women. So obviously it's affecting women disproportionately. And then just in terms of the climate being dangerous for women to go out, you know, we would go out at night when I was in Baghdad, and you'd have these outdoor restaurants, and so these streets would be mobbed with, like, you know, literally thousands of people out to eat. You know, you see two women on the street. You know, women are just not going out. So that's a problem. And so I want to actually talk. I wish I had more time to talk, but the whole question of the Iraqi resistance, because when we hear the news about Iraq, this is actually all we hear about. You know, a roadside bomb killed two troops today, or like this bomb killed a bunch of Iraqi policemen today. You know, this is what we're hearing about Iraq. And I wanted to, first of all, paint, I guess, talking about the resistance I wanted to show that Iraq isn't one-dimensional. There's a lot more happening than it just being a war zone. You know, there are all these other factors, too. But also the fact that in these horrific conditions that people have been subjected to, they're actually standing up. You know, they're not taking it lying down, and people are fighting back. There's a lot, though, that clouds the whole issue of the resistance. It clouds it for people both in the anti-war movement and in the society at large. I think, you know, people have probably seen, I don't have it, you know, yesterday or the day before, is newspapers that had this picture of, look at these Iraqi savages, you know, lynching these, you know, these poor civilian volunteers or whatever. And so that's the armed resistance. But I wanted to make the point, first of all, that the resistance actually goes beyond just the armed resistance, that the labor movement, for example, is a great example of resistance in Iraq. And the labor movement is absolutely taking off. There are, like I said, there are trade unions in Iraq which are organizing people. There are workers in the oil refineries which are being organized. And several oil refineries actually have gone on strike for higher wages. And I think when we talk about what kind of things can end the occupation, if you make it no longer profitable to run the occupation, you know, by controlling the oil, you know, I think that workers' power can play a huge role. But what about the armed resistance? I want to start by saying that at least whenever I hear reports on the radio, they're always prefaced with, it's been another violent day in Iraq, you know, two soldiers were killed. And the truth is, every day is a violent day in Iraq for Iraqi people, you know what I mean? And that's always left out. But the fact that they're living under occupation necessarily means that it's violent, even if they're not being shot at all the time. You know, their country's controlled by someone else, and that's a violent relationship. When we talk about, you know, the violence of the occupation, I think we have to understand that it flows from the violence of the resistance flows from the violence of the occupation. Those are the conditions that resistance fighters are making their decisions in. And I think a great example is this town, Fallujah, which is now, we know, is like the biggest hotbed of resistance and whatnot. It wasn't always like that. Actually, in April of last year, there was a demonstration against the U.S. invasion. It was a peaceful demonstration. People may remember it. Out front of the Ba'ath Party headquarters, which had been taken over by the United States. And so you had this peaceful demonstration, and the U.S. troops actually opened fire and killed several people. And the following day, there was another demonstration, and the same thing happened. You know, U.S. troops opened fire and killed people. And so we see what happens when people try to stand up peacefully. You know, they're confronted by these people with guns, and now we know that Fallujah is this hotbed of armed resistance. Just in terms of there's a whole lot of issues, again, that we could talk about with the resistance, and we should hit it up during the discussion. But, you know, part of it is we hear that's just the Sunni triangle. And, you know, I spoke with someone in Los Angeles who made the point that he thinks that they're trying to connect it to, like, the Bermuda Triangle, just, like, this mythical, weird place where, for some reason, people are just so, you know, loyal to Saddam, and there's just, like, this mythic kind of character, the Sunni triangle, that forces people to resist. When actually, people beyond the Sunni triangle are resisting, too. People may have heard that there were riots in Basra, actually, this past week, where British troops were clashing with Shia Muslims, so it's not just Sunnis. The question of the attacks, just attacking Iraqis, I think is important, because what we hear generally from the corporate media is that these resistance fighters are either savages, like we portrayed, you know, in the New York Times and every other newspaper a couple of days ago, or they're cannibals that, you know, they're actually the enemies of the Iraqi people, and they're attacking, you know, because they're attacking Iraqis all the time, and that's the way that Paul Bremer likes to paint them. But first of all, the attacks on Iraqis are the attacks on police officers, for example, are actually overly represented in the news media. They leave out all of the attacks on U.S. armed forces, which in December, people may remember, there were 30 attacks every day on U.S. forces. You know, I'm sure that number hasn't gone down that dramatically. I mean, the majority of attacks are still against occupation forces. But what about the attacks on Iraqi police officers or people signing up for the Iraqi army or whatever? And it's like, historically, empires have tried to establish a collaborator population, like a group of people in the country being occupied, so that, you know, who are for the occupation, that'll make the occupation easier. And I think that resistance fighters are trying to target those people to say, like, look, you're not going to be able to establish that kind of collaborator population. So I think it's important to understand that. Really briefly, people may have heard of the attacks. There are attacks like the one that happened at in Karbala last month. Karbala is the holiest city to Shia Muslims, and there was this huge pilgrimage to Karbala, and there were these massive attacks, you know, suicide attacks and mortars, and then scores and scores of people were killed. It was a really horrific event, and it's hard to say, like, how does this actually fit in with the resistance? But it's important to note that after those attacks took place, people at Karbala chanted, and in the funeral processions for the people killed, they chanted anti-American slogans. They chanted slogans against the occupation. That is, they blame the kind of violence and chaos that's going on right now. They see that as a direct result from the military occupation, and I think that that's important to note, to understand it in that way. There's a lot more I could say. I have to wrap up, but I think that it's really important, actually, in terms of how are we going to stop the war. I think that the armed resistance plays a huge role. You know, they're the resistance. They're part of the resistance on the ground in Iraq, which is crucial to ending the occupation. Just like I think we're part of the resistance here on the ground in the United States, and it's important for us to support the right of Iraqi people to resist. And so I'll leave it at that. But we should open it up and actually flesh that out, and I think that we'll do so throughout the weekend, actually.